Good evening, everybody. Birshus, Rabbi Eisenberg, and my parents, and everybody who came out tonight. I do have makoros to hand out.
Yeah, give me out.
Sure. It's good to be back at RZC, and I say back because six or seven, at times when I was a child, I attended the RZC Shabbatonim, which were very, very formative when I was a kid, and I grew up in RZC to that effect. So it is good to be back. Happens to be when I asked my father, do you know Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer? He said, yeah, I heard a shiur at the RZC Shabbaton by Rav Gedalia Dov Schwartz, he shall live and be well. So I guess I have big shoes to fill because hopefully you all haven't heard this already, but on the off chance that I have something to add to what he had to say, Rav Kalischer is a fascinating individual. And with that, we will begin. This is the Sefer Drishat Tzion. And in the back of this Sefer, is a Sefer written by Rav Kalischer, is a very, very big letter. Very large letter, double-sided. In our fonts, it is 12 pages long. Because, you know, that's how they wrote letters back then. And this is a letter that Rav Kalischer wrote to Baron Anshel Meir Rothschild, the eldest of the Rothschild children and the banker of Frankfurt, a slightly wealthy individual, as you can imagine. The letter had a very, very detailed and very comprehensive plan to settle Eretz Yisrael, a new concept back then, a big chiddush, and it was done, or rather, he suggested to do this to Rav Kalischer in four steps. Step number one, to buy cities and fields. And we'll talk about that soon. Number two, to migrate Jews from Europe and Russia and other areas to Israel. Number three, to set up a militia to guard against the Arab marauders and other people that would seek to attack the Jews. And number four, to establish an agricultural school / religious school to teach the importance of the land while also teaching how to work the land. And it was a very, very detailed letter. It was 12 pages long. The way, for example, how he explained to buy the cities and fields was, he said, very simple. There was a new ruler in Egypt in the early 19th century named Muhammad Ali. Not the boxer. And Muhammad Ali, just in short terms, he took over from the Ottoman Empire, from Egypt, and he was, to put it quite simply, strapped for cash. And while Rav Kalischer said, I know that he wouldn't be willing to just give up land for money, if you purchase large swaths of land in Syria and in Algeria, adjacent to Egypt, you could trade land and money for land in Israel. As a second option, very simply, just buy Jerusalem. Right? Halavai. Alternatively, and as a last resort, buy the Temple Mount. These are the three suggestions he sent to Rothschild. Ultimately, Rothschild never responded. I can imagine as a banker, you don't have a lot of time to read 12-page letters. And Rav Kalischer did go to another statesman, Rav Moses Chaim Montefiore, who was slightly more receptive. And he actually ended up discussing a similar idea with Muhammad Ali himself. Very interestingly enough, you can imagine what would have happened if that would have gone through. Montefiore's plan, not to get too off topic, was to have a 50-year lease where he would lease the money, we would lease the land from Muhammad to the Jews and get revenue and so on and so forth. But what this little story tells us, and what this letter tells us, is several very, very fascinating points, I believe. Number one, the letter quoted dozens of examples from Tanakh, from Gemara, from all over, about the importance of the land, the benefits that Rothschild will have himself. At one point in time, he compared Rothschild to Esther, saying essentially, you have the choice to save the Jewish people or to fade into history. The choice is yours. Maybe even you were given the wealth just for this purpose. It displays a very acute geopolitical knowledge of what was going on in the Middle East at the time. Now keep in mind, Rav Kalischer lived in Turin, which was in Polish or in Prussia, which was the Polish region that Prussia occupied. So, you know, they didn't exactly have text messaging or the internet back then. So he had an acute geopolitical knowledge of what was going on. And he had this business acumen to know that Rothschild would never acquiesce to just spend lots of money for no reason. But in the letter, he said, when you spend the money, then the Jews will come. You'll be able to rent land to them. They'll increase revenue. You'll get a lot of money. You can charge rent and so on and so forth. So, and this gives a unique look, I think, into why Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer was so multifaceted. Because you can see that he had all these different balls that he was juggling simultaneously. And at the same time, he displays in the letter and elsewhere the ideas that religious Zionists like Rav Kook later on used, and secular Zionists like Herzl himself used, Theodor Herzl, half a century before, 30 years before either of them were born, and half a century before they began formulating their ideas. So, who was this man is the question that I am going to discuss tonight, and how and what, where did he come from that he had such an extensive knowledge of Shas, geopolitics, business acumen, and this hang-up about moving to Israel? So if you look at the first page, you can see where Lissa, which is the city that he was born in Lissa, now called Lesno, in Europe. It's in a very, very specific place, which is the confluence between the East and the West. You see, it's right in the middle of the continent of Europe. And that was very significant. He was 11 years old when Napoleon invaded and conquered Prussia. So the forces of Napoleon and the ideas, the new ideas of nationalism and modernity that came with him, that was going on when he was in his teenage years. At the same time, he was a Talmud of Rabbi Akiva Eger. He was a Talmud of Rabbi Yaakov Lorberbaum, the Rimi Lisa, who wrote the Nesivas HaMishpat, who wrote the Chavastas, Gedolim of their generation, people that literally led the entire generation. And he remained close to them. So he had, and at the same time, he also, like we said before, he got these ideas from all over the place as to what was happening in Europe, the nationalism, the Haskalah that was taking root and growing. He saw that the Montefiores and the Rothschilds and other families had humongous amounts of money and were willing to help the Jewish people, other Jewish people that were in need, especially Montefiore, who spent a lot of money traveling all over Europe helping disadvantaged Jews. And it was due to this confluence that he developed ideas that we now know as religious Zionism. Obviously, they're from the Torah, but he couched them in the modern terminology, the concept such as a religious Zionist, which, again, is from the Torah, but he transformed it into the modern political entity, the modern nationalist concept, decades before anybody else did. Him, and it is important to note that simultaneously with him, there was another person in the Balkans named Rav Yehuda Alkalai who was doing the same thing. So this year is not about Rav Alkalai, but giving deference, he was also of a similar sort, actually very similar to Rav Kalischer, and they were actually close, but be that as it may. If you turn to source number one, he actually highlights, I'm glad that this is an RZC event, because source number one highlights something that I think sounds very familiar. This is in his additions to the Sefer Drishat Zion, which was, these editions were published in 1868. He said, 1868. So this was later on in his life. The letter to Rothschild was sent in the 30s, and over that entire period,
1830s.
In the 1830s, yes. I'm an old soul, so. in the 1830s, but by 1868, he had gone through, as we'll go through, a number of different ideas, a number of different conversations with very, very influential people, some which worked out more than others. But if we look at source number one, there's
a
oh, sorry. Excuse me. If you look at source number one, there's a concept here that I think we all, as members of RZC, find very familiar. It says, Echad hu Elokeinu, there's one God, uke'achduso b'char lo am echad guf ha-yisraeli, eretz achas nachlas am yisraeli, v'torah achas tu dab yisrael. There is one nation that Hashem bestowed his preference upon, one am yisrael, there is one eretz yisrael, and there is one Torah for them. And Shloshes Elek, Shurim, Bekeshra Amitz. There's a strong, strong connection between these three. Yisrael, Be'eretz HaKadusha, V'Torah. And it continues to speak about each one, how they're all connected to each other. But in essence, what he's saying, three quarters of a century before Rav Reines starts Mizrahi, is the concept of Am Yisrael, Eretz Yisrael, and Torah Yisrael being connected. Something that we all, I believe, that I at least, believe and hold strongly is source number two. If you look, it says, Gulas Yisrael asher anachnu chuchim, the geula that we're all waiting for, la, al yachshov hachoshev ki pitom yered Hashem yisparach shemo mishamayim ha'aretz, lomar la'amo so. Don't think that what's going to happen is Hashem's just going to come down and say, come on, let's go. No. And don't think, oh, Yishlach Mashicho ke rega mina shemayim litkoa shofar gadol al nidcha Yisrael v'yikvatzam Yerushalayim. And don't think that Mashiach's going to come with the giant shofar and herald all of us coming to Yerushalayim. Don't think that. And don't think v'yase la chomas eish u'miktash el mimromam teri. Don't think that the building of the Beis HaMikdash is just going to plop down on the Dome of the Rock and there will be Mashiach. That's not how this works. Kasher yiftiach al yadi avadav hanavim. And don't think that this is what the Nevi'im meant when they said all of their promises as what's going to happen in the Messianic age. Lo ken kara ha-maskil. That's not the intelligent way of thinking about this. Now, when I was a child, my father used to sing, there's a building still unfinished. There, way up high in the sky, there's a building still unfinished, the Mikdash HaShlishi. For a child, that's the image that we're going to one day come and it's just going to be there.
That was a Chabad song.
Oh, was it? I didn't even know.
Chabad believes that. We don't believe.
Okay. We don't believe that, exactly.
No.
So what do we believe? Vadaki. Vaday kol yudei anavim yiskaimu ba'achris hayamim v'lo yipol chasach halila davar arza v'lo b'menusa neilech v'lo b'chipazon yom echad. Don't think that what anything the Nevi'im were saying is false. Obviously everything that they promised is going to happen. Everything that they said was going to happen is obviously going to come true, down to the last iota. But Rome wasn't built in a day. Or in this case, Jerusalem wasn't built in a day. Rather, ma'at tavo geulas Yisrael, la'at la'at tatzmiach keren Yeshua. It will be a very, very slow process. We will have to move there. It will have to take effort. It will have to take toil. If you could look at the little picture down here, we will have to build the third Beis HaMikdash. We will need contractors, we will need construction workers, we will need people to do this. It's not just going to get done for us. There's going to be an avoda. There needs to be some element of our input in Mashiach. We can't just sit here. We need to go there. And these ideas, as for those that know Rav Kook, a lot of these ideas were later formulated and put into Orot and other Svarim of Rav Kook, and as well as Tzvi Yehuda, of course, and all the other early Zionists. But Rav Kalischer, as one of what we call the proto-Zionists, or the Zionists before Zionism, championed these ideas well in advance. But as important as the ethereal ideas of Mashiach, well, not in his case, hopefully, was, it wasn't just an interest in settling the land. And then, that's it. But his idea was much more grandiose in design. In fact, he had a long, long conversation with Rabbi Akiva Eger, and then the Chassam Sofer, and many, many other people about a much more significant topic, and one that, seeing as Pesach is in only a few weeks, hopefully relevant. And that is, can we bring the Korban Pesach bizman hazeh? Now, this is something that is probably not on most people's minds around this point in time. We say Lashana Haba Yerushalayim, but happens to be, if you look at the picture on page number 3, I found that apparently there's a group of people who every year, right before Pesach, they have a reenactment of the Korban Pesach from A to Z. If you see the pictures, they have Kohanim duchening with the begadim. They have a Mizbeach. They have, you should look at the bottom left picture, that's the goat running away. And they caught it. They shech the goat, they do Zrika Saddam, they do the whole nine yards, every single thing. It's in the Davidson Center, right outside of the Kotel, and they reenact the entire event. Now, it's amazing that they do this for them, and that's a unique thing. I don't think Rav Kalischer intended for that to happen, but the concept of bringing the Korban Pesach before Mashiach comes, before the third Beis HaMikdash, was not a new concept, and it's something that he spoke about with many, many, many of the most prominent Rabbanim of his time. To go through briefly just the background for this very interesting idea, we look at source number 3, the Mishnah in Idius, says, Amar Rabbi Yoshua, Shemati, I heard, Shema Krivin, Ap al pi she'ein bias, va'ochlin kadshe kadshim, that you can bring korbanos, even though there's no Beis HaMikdash. You can eat the korbanos, even though there's no klayim. You can bring meiser, even though there's no walls for the Beis HaMikdash. Why? Because kedusha rishona, kedusha l'shaisa, or kedusha l'asid lavo. Because once the land is consecrated, is kadosh, is holy, it's holy forever. Was, is, and will be always holy for the Jewish people, for the world. The Temple Mount is always holy. And this machlokas is continued in the Gemara. The Gemara in Zvachin said between Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish, Rabbi Yochanan says, or Itmar, Hamala Bizman Hazeh, can you bring korbanos? Rabbi Yochanan Amar Chayev. No, you are Chayev if you do so, but Reish Lakish Amar Pater. Why? Rabbi Yochanan Amar Chayev, because Kedusha Rishona, Kedusha L'Shaisa, Kedusha L'Asid Lava, that it is always holy. The holiness is part of the land, in essence. Reish Lakish Amar, no, Pater, why? Kedusha Rishona, Kedusha L'Shaisa, V'lo Kedusha L'Asid Lava. It's not about the land, it's about the building. When the building comes, there's Kedusha there. When the building is not there, there's no Kedusha. And happens to be, apparently, I read this in a similar article to the first one. There is a group that petitions the Supreme Court of Israel every single year for permission to sacrifice do the Korban Pesach on the Temple Mount. And every year it is denied, probably because they do not want World War III. But be that as it may, this question of does Har HaBayis have Kedusha Bizman Hazeh is something that was an actual machlokas, as we can see. Happens to be that until Hadrian, the emperor of Rome, banned Jews from entering Jerusalem in 135, so the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed in 70, for the 70-some-odd years, until 135, 65 years, korbanos were actually brought. And this attempt continued throughout the generations during the time of Julian the Apostate, who was the nephew of Constantine, and Constantine was the one that converted the Roman Empire to Christianity. Julian the Apostate tried to kind of reverse that decision, and one of the things he did was he gave the Jews permission to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash, which is a fascinating concept. This was in the 4th century, so the late 4th century, so 360, I believe. Julian died a few years later, and as we know, it was not fulfilled. But centuries later, Rabbi Yechiel of Paris, who was the Rebbe, one of the Balei Tosfos, he was the Rebbe of the Maharam Meirutenberg, who was the posek for all Ashkenazi Jewry during that time, he actually traveled to Eretz Yisrael intending on doing exactly this, bringing the Korban Pesach. He did not succeed, and eventually the conclusion was that we are not ready as a nation to do this. But it was always a conversation. If we look at the source number 5 in the Rambam, who lived in the 12th century, he died in 1204, the Rambam writes the same exact thing. He has the same conversation, right? Uma nis kadosh, what is kadosh, or how is the area kadosh? B'kedusha rishona shekedusa shlomo, shehu kiddush ha'azara v'yushalayim, v'sha'asan v'kidshan la'asid lavo. That from the time Shlomo first consecrated it, from that point in time on, it is always kadosh. And therefore, lefikach makrivin akarbanos kulan, afa pi she'ein sham bayis bono. You're able to bring korbanos, specifically the Korban Pesach for our purposes, but you're able to bring korbanos on the base on the Har HaBayis because there is a kedusha to it more than anywhere else. And the reason he gives at the bottom, you could see, shakedusha rishona, kedusha l'saisa, v'kedusha l'asid lavo. That's it. It is kadosh forever. The Ravid, who's a commentary on the Rambam, he takes severe issue with this. He says, look at source number 6. Before the Ravid, we understand that there's a lot of pluses for this, but there's also a lot of minuses. In that, if it's always kadosh, that means you can always bring korbanos there, yeah. But you also can't go up there if you're a tamei meis. You can't go up there if you're not a kohen miyuchas. You can't go up there in a number of situations, several of which we will enumerate when we get back to Rav Kalischer soon. But the Ravid very strongly disagrees. He says, "Efshar svaras atzmo hizu velo yadati manlo." I don't understand. It's impossible that he held this. I don't understand what he was saying or why he thought this, saying this of the Rambam. That if you look at the bold, kedusha rishona, lo kedusha lasid lavo. It's not forever. Lo chilek bein mikdash liyushalayim lashar Eretz Yisrael. Eretz Yisrael is kedusha, but Yerushalayim has no more than Eretz Yisrael. Below Ode, El Shani Omer, I think that Afilu Lerebi Yosi to Amar Kedusha Shnia, Kedusha Lasid Lavo, that opinion in the Gemara, that it does last forever. Lo Amar, Ela Lishar Eretz Yisrael. Aval Yerushalayim Ulemikdash, Lo Amar. We don't say this about Yerushalayim, we say this about all of Eretz Yisrael. We know Eretz Yisrael is Kadosh. And you see these yeshiva guys coming back from Israel. Even today, I saw them this morning in the 8 o'clock chakras that I davened at. Something about going to Israel for a period of time and coming back, they look different. There's a kedusha to Eretz Yisrael. It could be that they're just shuckling a lot harder than they did before. That's definitely a possibility. But whatever the reason may be, we know that there's a kedusha to Eretz Yisrael. But Yerushalayim, says the Ravid, it's exactly the same as everything else. And this was a serious issue for someone like Rav Kalischer, who sees the world and sees that, in his opinion, the time is now ripe to bring back the Korban Pesach and to do things like this. In regards to this machlokes between the Ravid and the Rambam, he has a very simple answer. He says, there's no issue whatsoever between them. If you say like the Ravid, there's no Kedusha. And you can bring Korbanos whenever you want, wherever you want, including the Har HaBayis. And if it's like the Rambam and there is Kedusha, then only bring it on the Har HaBayis, and you're fine anyway. So he covers both bases. The problem is, like we said before, there are many other issues with bringing korbanos. And here is where it gets relevant for Rav Kalischer, because this next source in Drishas Tzion gives us an insight into who he's corresponding with and what he does to further these goals on a consistent basis. Okay. You start from the top line. V'amnam es kulam yisar. Sorry, source number 7. Yes, thank you. Es kulam yisar ruach kafi asher nivara be'ezras Hashem mipi svaram mipi sofrim. We have to understand and explain what is going on here and why. There's many, many issues. There's 3 issues he enumerates. Kafi asher yiskimu al yadi. There are people that agreed with me in this regard. Who are they? Shnei gedolei olam, nuchi nefesh asher kol beis Yisrael naasan olamo. The greatest people of the generation, halohema adoni And before I continue, just to give a how much respect people had, specifically him, for their rabbeim, I'm going to count, side note, just count how many words he bestows upon his Rebbe. Halo Hema, Adoni Mori Varebi Hagon Hagadol Hachasid Va'anav, Rabban Shal Kol B'nei Hagola, Morenu Varabenu, Harav Akiva Eger Zecher Tzadik V'Kadosh L'Bracha. That's how you give kavod to a Rav. Wow. Nobody do that for me, please. Reb Shechter's coming next week. Do it for him. But be that as it may, his Rebbe, he said, I corresponded with Rebbe Akiva Eger, and he agreed with me on this. And also, the Achrav, Chasnu Agon Agadol Achasid, his Rabbi Akiva Eger's son-in-law, Morenu Barabenu Rav Moshe Sofer, Zecher Tzadik HaKadosh L'Bracha, the Chsam Sofer. Also, he corresponded with both of these individuals, the leaders of the generation, and they both, he says, agreed with him. Happens to be, if you look at the historical background, they were agreeing with him because they didn't know that he was planning on actually going to Israel and actually bringing the Korban Pesach. And in later letters, in later years, they say, yes, that's true, but we don't want to start World War III. So even if theoretically you could do so, let's not. That does happen. But at this point in time, this is in 1861. No, sorry, earlier than that. In the 1830s, rather. They both agree, at least in theory, that the Korban Pesach can be brought. But there are three big issues, he says. Hamanios Hema. Number one, Kikasha Me'od Livnos Mikdash Kisach Avanaso Asher Miyad Hashem Elokechem Alehem, sorry, Haskil Demus Tavniso. It's very, very hard to know exactly where the location of the Beis Hamikdash or the Mizbeach is supposed to be. You know, you're supposed to do it in the right place. Where is the right place? Number two, Shekulanu Tamei Mesim Ve'ein Lanu Afar Para Letarenu. How are we going to walk on the Temple Mount if we're all Tamei Meis, we're all impure, and we don't have the Para Aduma, the red heifer, the dust, to purify us? And problem number three. So Kohen Kasher Miyuchas Mizera Aaron. You need to have a Kohen Miyuchas, someone with a perfectly unbroken lineage from Aaron the Kohen. Now, by raise of hands, who here has a Kohen Miyuchas?
DNA.
DNA testing. So today we may be able to figure it out. I don't know if we have Aaron's DNA, but
apparently we do.
But be that as it may, it's impossible to know. It's been 1,800 years since the Beis Hamikdash was destroyed. How do you know who's a Kohen, Miyuchas, and who in the 12th century just decided to become a Kohen because they wanted to get an Aliyah every week? There's no way of knowing. So, how are you going to be able to have the Beis Hamikdash when you can't go on to the Temple Mount, because we're all tummy? We don't know where to bring it, and we don't know who can bring it. And he addresses each point individually. If we look at source number 8, he says there's no problem whatsoever with the location. Because Harinu Raya Barura, it's clear. We've all been to the Kotel. By raise of hands, who here has been to the Kotel? Everyone, many, many, many people have been to the Kotel. We know where it is. Until 1967, or from 48 to 67, we were not able to go to the Kotel. But now, if nothing else than looking it up on Google Maps, and I did, it's a 6-minute walk from the Kotel Plaza to the Temple Mount, according to Google Maps. Can disagree with them if you know. So, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, he says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us and promised us that there would be a chazakah, the Kotel would never be destroyed. We see, Kasher Rabbi Midim Sheholchin Lispal Le'umasa, that everyone goes and davens there all the time. So, Umasa Nochal Lachshov Makom HaMizbeach Kasher Nasa Cheshbon Tzedek Adak Heitiv Al Pi So use the Mishnah, use the Gemara, use the Rambam, and just calculate where exactly it is. No problem. He has a further, it was a 5-page piece, so I only put in one paragraph because we said less than 2 hours, right? But later on, he continues and explains that also just make the mizbeach a little bit smaller, so no matter what happens, okay, so you won't go an inch out here, inch out there. So that takes care of problem number one, which, if you think about it, is a very, it's true, obviously, but it's a very outside the box. It's something that requires some ingenuity, some thinking. This is not, you know, the standard, obviously, someone reads this and someone says, you know, actually, that taka, that makes a lot of sense. But that's not something that you would think of at first. At least not something that I would have thought at first. Problem number two, the tamei meis. He says, no. She'anachnu tamei meisim. Yeah, people say, mini ashenis, she'anachnu tamei meisim. Kvar, ni psaka halacha, we have a psak halacha, she'tuma hutra lekorban tzibor. That this concept of tuma hutra v'tzibor, that if there's a korban tzibor being brought, then there is no tuma, that the korban overrides the imperative of tuma. And apsaka rambam, kamandamar tuma dichuya b'tzibor, even for the rambam who says that no, it doesn't override it, sarech lishtadil la'asoso b'tara, we need to work to make yourself tahar, but mikol makom im kulam tamei mesim yochlin lahakriv kol korban tzibor, Kemo Korban Pesach is the example he gives, that if everyone's tamei, then you're able to give it, because the alternative is to never have korbanos. And chas v'shalom, how could we possibly not have korbanos? Again, an answer that makes sense, is very logical, and is rooted in sources, but something that takes a very inventive mind to think of. And for source number three, the problem of Kohen Miyuchas, he answers very simply. He says it's a Mishnah. Mishnah says there's a halacha l'mosh mi'sinai she'ein Eliyahu ba l'tamei v'l'taher l'rachek v'l'karev ela sherachek ha'mekorbin bizroa v'l'karev ha'meruchakin bizroa. That Eliyahu Hanavi is not going to come when Mashiach comes and make people tamei or tahar from far or from near to bring people in. He's here to do one thing, and that is bring people close who were brought away, and people that were distanced by force, that were forced away, to bring them in. That's what Eliyahu Hanavi does. And the Bar Anura explains that he's speaking about, when it says tamei and tahar, pure and impure, he's speaking about Kohanim. Right? He's not there that when Eliyahu Hanavi comes, when Mashiach comes, he is in essence going to matir, or going to make miyuchas, everybody who has a suffix. So Rav Kalasher says, we are about to start, and in the realm of Kabbalah, 1840 was supposed to be Mashiach. Happens to be, and draw whatever conclusions you want, according to most historians, the Industrial Revolution begins in 1840. He publishes Drishas Tzion in 1862, and the letter to Rothschild is in the 1830s. So this entire messianic concept is prevalent in the world at this point in time. He says, we're starting the messianic age. The Kohanim are already miyuchas. We're ready to go. So we see from these three examples and from this entire little condensed shir on Korban Pesach, that he has correspondence with and really close correspondence with the greatest individuals of the generation. He has an inventive, really, really unbelievable grasp of knowledge of Torah and of what's going on in the world and of what's happening in Israel in the Middle East. And he really has the entire grasp of everything that's happening in the world. So it happens to be that after years of petitioning wealthy Jews and speaking with Rabbeim about this issue, he published this sefer, Drishas Tzion. Drishas Tzion took the world by storm. It was unbelievably popular. He actually met with many, many Rabbeim, Rabbanim, including Rabbi Nathan Adler, who was the chief rabbi of Great Britain, the British Commonwealth at the time, Rabbi Huda Alkali, who we mentioned before, and someone who I graduated from the yeshiva that he is named after, Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector, the Rebbe of Kovno, all of whom said, Rav Kalischer, these ideas are amazing. You need to go through with this. You need to continue this. And so he did. In 1860, he actually started a movement, the Association for the Colonization of Palestine, the first national religious movement to make Aliyah, to move to Israel, to make this all happen. Again, half a century before Herzl, 30 years before the World Zionist Congress, the first World Zionist Congresses. And that organization didn't last, but not to be deterred, he went up to the Alliance, which was a French organization dedicated to increasing knowledge throughout the disadvantaged areas where Jewish people lived. And he set up an agricultural school called the Mikveh Israel Agricultural School. Right? Constantly, we see that he was the rabbi of a town named Torin in Poland, or in Prussia, rather. He's a rabbi of a town who also goes to Britain, who goes to Kovno, who I was reading, and he was in Tehran, in modern-day Iran at one point in time, traveled far and wide spreading this message that when he was there, didn't bear fruit. He died in 1974. Many of his dreams and many of his hopes. Guess I'm not such an old soul. In 1874, with many of his dreams and many of his hopes unfulfilled. But if you look at the writings of Herzl, the concepts of agricultural schools, of defense organizations, are concepts that he championed. And it's not that crazy to think maybe Herzl got his hands on some of the writings of Rav Kalischer. Herzl's grandfather actually did blow shofar in the shul of Rabbi Yehuda Alkalai, who was Rav Kalischer's close contemporary. And you know, it's possible to think that maybe he read these ideas and he thought, you know, this is something that needs to happen. Same thing with Rav Kook. Right? Rav Kook, the concepts of all of Am Yisrael as one entity that has this national imperative to move to Israel and to fix the world by being in Israel and by reaching out elsewhere, right? The land being part of our identity. These are all concepts that Rav Kook, that now every religious Zionist in Israel and in America, I can imagine, that's what we believe. But 50 years before Rav Kook, Rav Kalischer was saying the same exact thing. Also, the kibbutz Tirat Zvi in Israel, named after Rav Kalischer, is the premier producer of high-quality hot dogs in the region. Fun fact. So if nothing else, at least if you go to Israel and you get a good hot dog, you know where it came from. So we can see that decades before anyone who we think of as the founders of Zionism and religious Zionism were born, there are people like Rav Kalischer that were tirelessly working, that were traveling across the globe, trying to make this vision of settling the land of Israel a reality. And while in his lifetime it may not have borne fruit, imagine if he can see the world that we live in today, where Israel is not just in existence, but where it is rapidly becoming one of the world superpowers, Emirat Hashem, where it's growing by leaps and bounds, and where every day comes a new challenge and a new opportunity. So I hope that did justice to really an incredible man, Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer. Thank you all so much for coming and listening, and for giving me the opportunity to share some Torah and to share some biographical information about a truly, truly fascinating man.